Hey, Drew and Jonathan Scott here. Build a customized renter's policy with American Family Insurance so you can protect your tandem bike on the go.
Thief!
Oh, he is struggling with that two-seater. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at amfam.com.
Some exclusions may apply. Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies. 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here. American Family Insurance can help protect your dream home for whatever comes next. You can live in your own oasis or your own clubhouse. Whatever you choose, get the right coverage. Save up to 23% by bundling home and auto. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at amfam.com.
Visit amfam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies. 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hi, everybody. As some of you may know, over the past couple of years, I've done several webinars and video lectures on a variety of topics that also come up on this podcast. There is unfortunately a lack of qualified therapists who specialize in working with cult survivors and their concerned family members. And since I can only see a finite number of clients myself, I wanted to share insights from my 30 plus years of doing this work with as many people as possible. So, in pursuit of that goal, I've made all of my recent video lectures available on my website, rachelbernsteintherapy.com. You can find a link to the page in the show notes of this episode. There you'll find my lecture from the most recent conference of the International Cultic Studies Association, my quote, Living in Freedom, unquote, series for survivors and their family members, and my recent lecture entitled Why Did I Stay?, which examines the many reasons that people have difficulty leaving high control groups. We plan on adding more video lectures in the near future, so if you have topics you'd like to hear me cover, please feel free to reach out to us and make suggestions. Hi, everyone. Lynn Short was an active member of the modern occult group known as the New Gnostic Society. She was in it for 17 years. She and her husband were missionaries for roughly 9 years until leaving in 2018. The New Gnostic Society was conceived by a man in Colombia named Victor Rodriguez, who in the late 40s proclaimed he had awakened his consciousness and was now the god of Mars. His faith is a hodgepodge of turn-of-the-century occultist theory, New Age thought, Catholicism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Kabbalah, and indigenous spiritualism, to name a few. After realizing the teachings and the culture of the group were the main reason for her suffering, Lynn knew she could not in good faith continue with the organization, and she left. Approximately 3 months later, her husband was, quote-unquote, fired by email. It's been 6 years now of religious trauma therapy, and Lynn's life is much better, much happier, and she's so much freer. Lynn wanted to share her own experience in the hopes that others could find healing in her story and to encourage people on their own journeys of healing from religious trauma. Here is Lynn now. I am delighted to have Lynn Short with me today. It is so nice to be able to talk to you. I was actually, as I told you, I was really looking forward genuinely to this conversation because I know a little bit about you and a little bit about your story, but I love these opportunities to really explore and to find out more and for you to be able to educate the public, but also be able to say things that you might not have been able to say before or talk about or have a venue for. And so it's all very exciting, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time.
I would love to also hear about you and have the audience hear about you too. And what do you do when you're not doing podcast interviews on indoctrination?
My life, thankfully, is really basic. Like I'm just a person, which is great. It's really nice not to have to try to become something extraordinary, which was my life in Gnosis. I'm just a massage therapist, and I am very much trying to get back into writing, doing poetry, and cultic studies have kind of been my, since getting out, have been kind of a nerdy thing for me to deep dive into, because it helps me to kind of suss out what happened.
Let's talk about all of it, as much as we can cover today. And if we run out of space and time, so to speak, then I'm sure you can come back and we can continue talking. But let's get going with a little bit about you previous to Gnosis, and just so we know about your history.
Previous to coming into Gnosis, I grew up as a kind of secular person. My dad was pretty much an atheist. My mom didn't push any religion on any of us. She wanted that to be our own decisions to make, which on the one hand is great because there's no pressure. On the other hand, there was literally no guidance, which I didn't mind. I wasn't missing that until after college. I graduated from college with a psych degree and a minor in philosophy. So you can see where my interests are with that. And after a few years of sort of stumbling around, not really wanting to do the entrance exams that would take me to probably further my career in psychology, I was missing academia. I was missing study. I was missing sort of that mental crunchiness that happens with all of that. And after graduating massage school, I ended up in Portland. And in the Gnostic teaching, most of it is done by flyers. And at the time, I don't think it could quite fly the same way. But at the time, like that's kind of how you would locate a center of Gnosis is, you know, there would be flyers out because the internet wasn't what it is. This is, you know, this is before cell phones. You know, we were still in the dial-up age, which is really amusing. So, you know, as technology evolved, so did the access to all kinds of information. So I found a flyer and I took it to my friend to give to him and his girlfriend because they were kind of into this new age, like create your own reality kind of stuff. And I was just like, okay, here you go. And side note, the friend I was giving the flyer to, I was absolutely in love with. Like, here it is for you and your girlfriend. And she was uninterested. She was absolutely uninterested. And I was like, oh, well, I'll follow you to this guy's random house. And so most of the centers are just in a missionary's house. And it's sort of scholastic. Like, it's this grand, you know, huge circle of information of different religions, different theories, different philosophies, and it's sort of mashed together into the shape of Gnosis. And it kind of floored me. It was like, oh, this is that spark I was looking for in bettering myself and in understanding myself. That here it is, this package. You know, I don't have to do an entrance exam. I don't have to do the regular thing. And I leaned toward contrarian lifestyle anyway. So it was kind of perfect. And here was my friend who was like, oh my God, this is amazing. So let's do this together.
Right. How appealing. Also, just to say, you know, when you get the sense, and I like this idea of you calling it sort of scholastic, right? Because that gives a sense about how there was, I think, the appearance of, or the guise of, someone being very scholarly and well-read and having synthesized all of this information, sort of done all the hard work for you. And now you can jump in and, you know, just receive the gifts of all of their, you know, synthesis. and all the knowledge and acquired everything. And then you find out it's a little bit different than that. But I could imagine the appeal, at least initially, and also the love interest, which is not to be, you know, kind of overlooked in a lot of these situations where people are following someone or they're, I mean, a lot of cultic groups will use recruiters who are very attractive or very charismatic for that reason. Okay. All right. So here you were now surrounded by these philosophies, religions, theories, and this person who you were digging. And then what happened?
And I will say that, so the person in Portland, this all happened in Portland, the person in Portland who was running this center was not the guru. The guru had died 1977. So all of this sort of traveled through Colombia, up through Mexico and into the US, and whoever his leader was decided he should go forth and teach. And so he did. And you spread it around by moving to other places. Just kind of caveat, kind of giving context for, you know, he wasn't claiming he was the creator of all the knowledge, but he was very much the orator of it. But we all were.
Right. Okay. Can you tell us also a little bit about the person who put this whole thing, this whole group together, and what you know about him?
So he was born in early 1900s. I want to say 1917 or something, and died in 1977. His name was Rodriguez, is his last name. At some point, he awakened his consciousness in the late 40s and became Samael Onvior, which is the god of Mars. And so he became God, that God here on Earth, to become the Kolki avatar of the new age of Aquarius. He was this awakened masters, and it was his responsibility to reveal to the world the true awakening, you know, how a person can truly awaken their consciousness fully and no longer be a physical being. So you could ascend off of this life. It's very Hinduistic in some ways, because he plagiarized a lot of different things. Hinduism, a lot of the early occultists, Blavatsky, for example, Steiner, for example. Yeah, Masons, the Rosicrucians, like all of that was kind of also going on during when he was born, like the occult period. Yeah, you know, so that was kind of the new age thing was being born, and he rode that.
Yeah. I joked to people that just with my skewed education in cults, I might not be able to find like a certain thing on a global map, but I know who Madame Blavatsky is.
Right. Right.
That's not
right.
Okay.
Right. That Steiner. And, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mesmer, okay. All these different people. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, the thoughts create your own reality, you know,
yes.
People.
Right. Go ahead.
So, and he was unhappy with Catholicism. He was unhappy with the way the world was turning, you know, probably more progressive, maybe not in Colombia as much, but like, you know, the signs were there. And anyway, he awoke his consciousness, and the crux of the teaching are these three things: the birth of the soul, the death of the ego, and the sacrifice for humanity, all of three which rotate around the sexual practice, which is having sex with a married partner, but not having an orgasm. So you're edging for all of your sexual encounters, ideally. And you are sacrificing the energy of your sexual center to create your soul, to kill the ego. So any attachments you have, your personality, your habits that you do, the bad things that you observe in your daily life about you, you are supposed to take to the altar of sex and have your divine mother destroy it in a fire of whatever. And again, some of the details are kind of vague now. So,
right. Okay. And so this idea of also not having orgasms, that you know, that is talked about in different groups where there is this need to have this level of self-control. And there are different ideas given for it, why that is an idealized way or optimal way. What was the reasoning here?
Because the sexual energy was not yours to own. So your body really isn't yours. That's for your being. The sexual energy isn't yours. It's for your being. And that's the most powerful energy you have. Like, it's better, faster, purer than your mental capacity to masticate ideas and thoughts. Faster, better than your emotions. Quicker, the best, whatever. And it is the thing that reinvents you so that you don't have to have certain levels of karma, or you get to be new. You get to be born through this process. And if you have an orgasm, just to throw a little cherry on top of that, it is the worst sin that you can do, because it's your own self-will taking something away from God because you're having the orgasm. The energy of the orgasm is, again, not for you, it's for God. So no pressure. For me, after, you know, we were in for 17 years, at some point after so many other stories, but after some point when we moved to Spokane to start a new missionary life, we'd been missionaries in Portland for about 5 or 6 years, and we moved to Spokane to start again. At some point in that time zone, not being able to prevent having an orgasm became almost impossible for me. And that whole part is like so painful for me to have dealt with, because the pressure of having the orgasm is so intense. It means so much in the teaching. You know, it's only black and white. The teachings only speak in absolutes. The guy only wrote in absolutes, Samael. And I actually went to several different other missionaries who I valued their opinion, and to ask, like, okay, this is what's happening. How do I change this? How do I do stuff differently? Like, what can I do? Because this is the thing I'm supposed to not do. And by the way, these orgasms aren't delightful. Like, they're painful because I'm really resisting having them. And it's not like we're having lots of movement. The idea is like you put a penis in and you say mantras and you move as little as possible. This is not sexy sex. You're supposed to be meditating on your daily insights, your comprehensions into how bad you've been that day, and, you know, focus on your divine mother. And you can, you know, of course, it's endorsed that you know, send out affection to your partner. It's not supposed to be loveless or unsacred, but with all the other stuff that you're supposed to be doing, you know, and me trying to restrain from having these orgasms, didn't matter how long we'd been doing it. It wasn't like a 3-hour session and oops, I have an orgasm. It just, sometimes it would be just there it is. There's this penis and now I'm having an orgasm. Like, I'm not prepared for it. That wasn't very frequent, but sometimes it just, that's what genitals do, apparently. So the advice that I got was just bad advice. It was like platitudes and like, you're not praying enough. You clearly are wanting to have an orgasm. You're lying to yourself. So you need to stop that. You need to just, you know, have 3-minute sex. If that's, you know, that's your karma, that's great. Do a lot of pranayama, breathing exercises. You're not doing enough of that. You don't love your divine mother, you know, on and on, on with that.
Okay. So I think, you know, it is a very cruel thing, and not unlike kind of fundamentalist
purity culture.
Purity culture, exactly. Where you are really made to feel like you are evil, that you are not deserving, that you have no control, that you're sinning in some way, you're weak in some way, just because you can't manage a primal drive and you can't manage your body responding to something in a natural way. And also that people will talk about having orgasms in their sleep. So you know, what do you do, right? You're just going to wake up feeling like a horrible person.
Well, you're supposed to be conscious in your sleep. You're supposed to be lucid in gnosis and prevent those from happening as well.
Right. And that's never going to be successful. And so it's like setting people up for failure and self-flagellation,
shame.
Basically, and shame. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder also just about him. I don't know if this ever got disclosed, but sometimes leaders who have these prohibitions have issues themselves, like they have either ED or they have their own stuff going on, which already makes them be able to have an easier time with limiting themselves in this way. And so they either expect the same of others or they kind of take it out on others.
Yeah, I don't really know. He did father five children, which is interesting. And that's sort of glossed over. And then there was the third secret wife that he had later on. So, oh, yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, so he married for the short history that I know of, and I had access to this because I'm a missionary. This isn't written anywhere. Missionaries tell each other these stories. So he married one woman and had a son with her, and then it was revealed to him by his being that he should marry this indigenous woman and learn indigenous spirituality with her. And so he had four or five children with her. I think it's four. And then she at some point, you know, either didn't want to have sex anymore, or we were told she had an accident in a car accident and couldn't for some reason. Maybe she had a back problem. And so then there was the secret third person that's never written about in the books. But, you know, he's got to awaken his consciousness fully, and that requires sex.
Mm-hmm. My goodness. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Oh, yeah. Big time. Right. Welcome to how it mostly is.
Yeah, because he's awake. He gets to be outside of the box. You don't.
You don't. Right. Right. Got you. Okay. Okay. So then going back to your experience. So I know that this is all woven into your experience too. But so tell us more about this, your time there, and also how long again?
17 years.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there are a lot of stories to share. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
Part of what I'm going to go into is like context of the religion and then also my process of that. So in the religion, there's the pressure to be positive. So you're ideally not leaning into your negative emotions or your negative thoughts. And so the pressure to feel positive under negative and stressful situations kind of eventually made it like impossible for me to understand what I was actually feeling about gnosis or doing this teaching as a practitioner. And then when we became missionaries, I had a lot of anxiety and a lot of stress regarding that, for multiple different reasons. But you're not supposed to speak about your own pain. You're supposed to kind of like keep that inside, because to speak about it is egoic and selfish. Like you're expressing the ego by expressing any negativity at all. And this is especially true if you were a missionary. Like you can't break down in front of your students. And it couldn't be the doctrine's problem. It had to be your problem. The doctrine's going to be true with a capital T. So in my opinion, and observing myself this way, I began to feel very paranoid, because as with the orgasm problem I was having, like negative thinking, negative emotions means this is where you're missing the mark of the ideal of cleaning up yourself, being your own self project and becoming enlightened. So having things to see means something about who you are as a person. And I just don't think it's really healthy to evaluate yourself to that degree, because it was like, you're supposed to observe yourself and become very passive. You're not supposed to be thinking actively a lot. And so any slip up is an indicator of where you've gone wrong. So lots of thought control, lots of emotional control, lots of behavioral control.
So throughout, I mean, I think people, when they hear these terms, I don't think they realize how much it rotates through your mind and becomes so pervasive, so all-encompassing. It's one of the things that people have a hard time with after they leave, right? So just if you can, it might be hard to remember. And if it's hard to remember, that's actually a good thing. So if you can't remember it all, yay, because then it's been some time. But typically, sort of within a few minutes' time, what would your thoughts be about your emotional control, behavioral control, all of it?
So it sort of evolved. Like in the beginning, it wasn't quite so chastising. But as I learned more about the doctrine, and it also kind of depends on your missionary, how fundamentalist are they with their approach with the doctrine? And how loose they are with the doctrine, how compassionate they can be with the weird thing of being a human, or how like, no, you are, you know, blah. So as more responsibility was put on me, it felt like there was more of a need to clean all of that up. And on a daily basis, by the end, it was, you know, I have a thought of Sally and I'm angry at Sally and fuck, I'm angry at Sally. And so there's this resistant about being angry at Sally because I shouldn't be. And any kind of fantasy that I might have about having an argument with her or having a conversation with her, it's going to devolve into this chaotic, anxiety-ridden mess of wanting to push it away. And knowing I'm supposed to see it so I can evaluate it, so I can practice my nightly meditation. And if I have sex or not is irrelevant, but I'm supposed to meditate nightly and reevaluate my day and bring myself to the altar to sort of beg my divine mother to comprehend this and diminish it for me. And the interesting part is I never once felt diminishment of ego. I might feel a mood shift, which is something completely different. Like, you know, you go outside, you do some deep breaths, you see nature, like your mood shifts. The main thing that's there is just being repressed. That's what's happening, at least for me, and I imagine many other people.
Right. Okay, got you. Okay, so then tell us more about your experience and also a relationship within this, you know, and how that all gets figured out. How you, while you're trying to do all this self-exploration, I'm sure there were these sort of relational explorations you were supposed to be doing as well, and dealing with a lot of stress that was placed on you in a very unnatural way.
I think what saved me and Justin, honestly, was my husband. We had a relationship, a friendship long before Gnosis. So we had an established grounding of how to relate outside of all of this. And so, you know, we could be quirky and fun and support each other and do things that didn't include Gnosis, which was unusual for most couples. There were couples who I knew who, even though they went on vacation, they would dialogue with each other mostly about how the classes were going and how to get more students. And, you know, so I think as far as managing our own relationship, that really helped us, is that we had a friendship prior to, like, 7 years before we went into Gnosis. But there is a disconnecting and I think a diminishing of the relationships you have, because you're supposed to be so insular, you're supposed to be so focused on yourself as this ultimate project, that you kind of lose sight of the value of community, the value of social justice, the value of politics, that, you know, you lose all of those connections, because also it's an apocalyptic cult, of course, you know, the end of the world is nigh, and only the Gnostics will inherit the new golden age, you know, yada, yada. So there's no need to clean up or be concerned about anything around you. So again, no pressure.
Sure.
So one of the things that became a significant pain for me, like an emotional weight, was I'm more of an introvert, maybe an ambivert, because I really enjoy people, but I relish my time alone. That's where I find solace. It's where I heal. It's where I get to just stare at the wall and blow spit bubbles. You know, it's fine. Being a missionary, like I think we went to course, this other story. We went to the missionary course in 2007. And from then on, we were just doing classes. And this was 4 and 5 nights a week. We're responsible for teaching and working our jobs and maintaining the rent. And ideally, you weren't buying a home because, again, the end of the world is nigh. And you're not supposed to own things. You're supposed to be flexible. And at some point, you would give your center to another missionary so that the students, they were all called students, by the way, and you know, they're not members, they're not congregants, they're students. And so you're supposed to hand your students off to another missionary so that they get the teaching gleaned through another set of eyes so that they don't become dependent upon you. So that's bad. Yeah. So, you know, here I am immersed in people every night, and I'm a massage therapist at this time. So I'm giving to my clients and I'm giving to these students and I'm writing lectures and I'm listening to lectures and I'm having to meditate and I'm supposed to do the sexual practice and I'm, you know, just a lot of stuff that you're supposed to do, which up until, I swear to God, last week, I was like, you know, how cults use their members as free labor. And it wasn't until this last week that I was like, we were their free labor. We were their free labor. We were not paid. We were not clergy. We weren't chaplains. We weren't monks. We weren't, you know, we weren't paid. We weren't given home and, you know, room and board. We did all of the labor of teaching for free. The students could donate to us, but there was no expected tithing amount or anything. But, you know, there was this implied like, well, they're going to help you. They're going to pay your rent. And if you can't pay rent, then that's you teach out of your car.
Wow. Oh my goodness. Wow. So here you were not given the title, right? Not given that kind of respect, that the hierarchy is maintained and you have to stay beneath, but still being there, what, 4 or 5 nights, which becomes your whole life.
Yeah. Cause it's out of the house that I live in. So,
oh my goodness,
there isn't escaping it.
And that you say just last week, you realized that you were the free labor. I mean, it's like a slow burn because you don't know that that was the intention or there's a part of people, I think, that doesn't necessarily want to see what we don't want to see. It takes a while to get there. A long while, actually. Yeah. So, right. So here you were really used and exhausted. And could you feel yourself getting more exhausted? And if so,
oh yeah,
what would be?
And my anxiety.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, like earlier I had mentioned about the toxic sort of positive skin you're supposed to put on everything, because you're not supposed to be identified with any of that. Like if you're angry, you can be like, I am angry, but you can't be, I'm angry. So as introverted as I may be on the scale and the constant influx of people and activity and my anxiety for A, wanting to do well, like I really dutifully wanted to do this well. This was the most important thing in my life, aside from Justin, like making sure I understood the doctrine fully, that I applied it completely, that I taught it well and succinctly, like all of that was super important. So there's that pressure of like performing for the rest of my life. As far as I know, there's no retirement, there's no assistance. So there's the anxiety of wanting to do well. And then there's the anxiety of having people around you all of the time that you're wanting to do well for. And I am not supposed to express any of that. And when I would talk to the few people that I did talk to about my unhappiness, that was the thing I was supposed to sacrifice. So earlier, it was birth of the soul, death of the ego, sacrifice for humanity. Well, that's my sacrifice. I'm needing to. So if I'm feeling unhappy, that's my problem. You know, so there's a lot of blaming victim going on, because that's true for all the other students as well. Like, if they're experiencing negativity in their life, we're telling the students in our very pseudo-therapy way, we'll get to that, you know, how they need to manage that. And which is mostly, don't feel it, you know, meditate on it, reflect on it, see where your part in this is, so that you can die in it.
So that you can die in it. Okay, you mean like the ego death or?
Ego death, for sure, ego death, like metaphorical death.
Right, right, gotcha.
But there are the few people who have killed themselves, you know, that's also in our more recent history.
Oh, can you talk a little bit about that, just to kind of honor them?
Yeah, because so all of that was my missionary existence. And some scandals happened, which I'm happy to go into great detail about. But one of the last straws that broke my back to get me out was this particular missionary couple. I did not know them personally. A student had moved that we had moved into their area and was attending their classes. And there was just such a denial of Olivia's, I will speak her name, Olivia's pain from what the student said. And she eventually killed herself. And then the gentleman who was running that group, about a month later, he closed the school for about a month, and then about a month later started seducing his student. And then about 3 months within a 3 month period of him and his wife killing herself, he's married again. Cause it's a very hookup culture. The fork is the sexual aspect. So you have to be together with someone. And if you're not, then that's your bad karma, or the being will provide at some point, vaguely in the future. And if you have problems in that relationship, you are not to get divorced. You're supposed to just observe all of that. And so there is domestic abuse that can happen. I knew of one woman who was being raped by her partner on a regular basis, but she thought she had to die in that. So she wasn't forthcoming until it exploded in her brain, because eventually that's going to happen. And then, you know, there's other abuses that come out. The weight of being a missionary really messes with your brain. And so, you know, like if your students aren't doing what you're wanting to do, I know of situations where, you know, people have just screamed at their students inappropriately. And we're not, you know, our training is a 3 month period of training, and we are not told anything about trauma and dealing with that. We're just there to be spiritual advisors. But all the Gnostics, the missionaries that I knew, played at doing therapy, which I found to be later on, it was like, this is inappropriate. We should not be, like, we can advise people on a prayer they can use, but we should not be telling people what they should be doing for their mental health. We should not be telling people what they should be doing for their physical health. We are not educated in any of that. And that's way outside our scope of practice. And I profess that I would do that at times because I thought that was what I was supposed to do.
Yeah. I mean, that's very tied in with this whole idea of moral injury. You know, when you are left with this trauma and guilt and shame and even anger, the situation being put in the middle, like being given that kind of power to dissuade people from taking their medication, from not pursuing the psychiatric care that they need.
Yeah. Or not getting a secondary education. There's so many Gnostics that are like, no, you don't need to go go to school and change your career. They're just going to fill your head with bad information. I didn't feel that way because I had a secondary, you know, I had a secondary degree. I had a BA and, you know, wanted to do more, but, you know, I didn't have that opinion about education. It's like, no, you just go there and you get to make up your own mind about stuff.
Yeah. So what sort of advice, just as an aside, what sort of advice did you give people if they were having an issue, let's say, or an emotional issue? What was your go-to that you were taught to tell people?
A lot of it was kind of rolling back into using the practices of gnosis. So you're observing yourself and you're trying to, these weird vague terms, you're trying to distance yourself from being identified by the emotion that you're having and the problem that you're having. You should change your center. Was there's so much loaded language in gnosis.
No, it's fine. It's actually really interesting to hear it because that just shows how much it's not going to be translatable to the general population. It's like this whole other, I don't know, whole other world that you step into.
It really is. So you change your center by, if you're having a bad day emotionally, then you do something physical. If you can't stop your thoughts, then you go take a run, you know, and some of that might arguably be helpful. But again, that's about changing mood, not fixing anything. That's not true emotional change. That's not work in turn, you know, 6 years of therapy later, I'm like, oh, yes, I understand a therapeutic process to that much. Like, you know, I'm not trained in it. I just understand like, oh yeah. And for me personally, like I like to intellectualize stuff. I like to tease things apart and find out information and having done a lot of deconstruction, that has been healing in its own process. Being able to listen to different podcasts, yours, the Conspirituality Guys, reading different books, you know, it's been really helpful to be able to hear other people articulate their own process because I can understand my own process. It's not the same. It's just it's different flavors of the same shitty soup. But you can glean from each other from that. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So yeah. So keep going. So tell me more about your experience.
Okay. I'll tell the big story. Two things really started to crumble for me because I was really trying, you know, I was too busy in Portland with 4 and 5 nights a week of doing things with gnosis. Also there's explicit and implicit directives as far as missionaries go. The implicit is that you will not have a vacation. You will not take time off. That's lazy. That's your personality telling you you need a day off, which you don't. That's the ego. So you need to just structure your life always forever about this. So we move here and I finally have a bit of time before we're busy again with new students. And one of the directors of our particular branch of gnosis, because there's several, you know, Samael dies and like several branches of gnosis form off of his dead corpse. You know, they all kind of battled with each other, the people who directed these branches, as to how it was proper to do gnosis. And so our directors are two people, some guy in Rome and another guy in Australia. And one of the guys had said that New York was going to, by the end of 2015, New York was going to fall into the ocean. There was either going to be a natural disaster or some sort of explosion was going to happen. And that was definitely going to happen. And then it didn't, you know, interesting. And I kind of told myself, like, because I was already having issues with the doctrine because it doesn't make sense. It's such a galaxy brain of ideas and philosophies that it's just, nothing's coherent. And I had told myself, like, if that happens, then I am a Gnostic by God. I am on board with everything. Well, it didn't happen. And that was like, oh, that's not great. And then we were told, like, oh, the reason it didn't happen was because there's enough Gnostics on the planet doing the work, the good work. And so the Lords of Karma have decided not to punish the planet. And I'm not really kidding. I'm being silly about it, but I get to.
No, I was curious actually what you were going to say as the explanation. Every group, Jehovah's Witnesses has done this a bunch of times. There's a prediction of the end of the world, and then there's some reason that it didn't happen. And it's usually something that is lauding the group in some way, in the leadership, and the fact that, you know, people were able to get money to come into the organization because the end of the world was coming, or they were able to recruit more people or bring more of this to the world and it saved the world. That, yeah, so I, because of how many times I've heard that, that's why I did not even react when you said but, but yeah, it's just, it's so horrible to do to people, especially when, if they're people living in New York who are now terrified, right?
Right. No, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think you end up looking like a fool because you've made this prediction and it doesn't happen. But the word on high is that you've done good work. So the bad thing didn't happen. So that happened. And, you know, my facade is starting to really crumble. I'm having the trouble with my sexual practice, getting really bad advice, terrified, anxious, because we're not doing enough work. We can't seem to get students to stay in Spokane. It just seems to be this revolving door and it's not working like it used to, and all of this. And then the cherry on the top is the person that we left in charge of the Portland school had married one of the students rather quickly and got pregnant with her. But then we trusted him with these people that we had become very close to. These students were our friends and they weren't supposed to be. We were supposed to disconnect any connection with them after we left, and we didn't. And comes to find out a couple of years in that he is raping his wife on a fairly regular basis. This is a different one than the other one that I told you about. He's also having sex with one of the students, telling her that he is helping her karma by having sex with her. You know, it's because he's awake. He doesn't need to do the work anymore. He's just here to help them because they don't understand the work. And all of what we taught was wrong, meaning me and Justin. And the young woman tells me about her relationship with Davin, the guy. And I end up, of my own accord, talking to other people that I thought would help, that I thought could do something about this, because this was absolutely wrong. And he was also grooming two other women, comes out. And as a scandal do, stuff starts to fall apart. And God, I'm still affected by it. So mad. So while I was not naive enough to think that a scandal like this couldn't happen in Gnosis, you know, people make mistakes, people are bad, whatever. The thing that was unexpected for me was how poorly all of it was handled. The young woman got thrown under the bus. It was her fault because she was seductive. Justin and I wanted to go down because the entire school was having panic attacks, and we wanted to go down there and cry and scream with them and validate their pain. And we were told not to because we were too attached to their well-being. And the other people would come down from Seattle and take care of all of it when they are only concerned with the optics of Gnosis. They're less concerned about the trauma everyone is going through. So Davin gets fired essentially and told not to teach anymore. But that was the student's choice. The students could choose to continue with their abuser or they could get new missionaries. So they chose new missionaries. And the missionaries come and they are immediately told to no longer think about that event, that that's in the past and that's egoic and you should be in the now and look forward. So no one's dealing with the trauma of these people. And the woman of the couple that came down from Seattle is a mental health counselor. And there are several mental health counselors in Gnosis. And I do not understand how, with their training in trauma, with their training that it takes to be a therapist, how they can cognitively disconnect the pain of gnosis with their training. I don't get it. Not where my anger still is. Like, we are not trained to do this well. Not even as spiritual leaders. Like a monk is taught for years. A chaplain goes through a program. We're 3 months and we get, hey, good luck.
Right. There are mental health professionals who get involved in these kinds of groups, and they can rise to the top sometimes too. And, you know, you had that in Nexium. You have that in 3HO, actually. And
Landmark, probably.
With Yogi Bhajan. Landmark, yeah. And also the idea of, oh yeah, right? And higher ups in TM and a lot of places. There are also a lot of gurus,
yeah,
and others who will say, who will use the word karma as a justification for doing a lot of bad things. That they are fixing, they're healing, they're repairing, they're whatever, fill in the blank, karma. This is for your benefit. And some people actually, some of the gurus believe that. And other people who, you know, just want to get away with things know that that's an easy out. And then people are left, you're supposed to feel grateful for having been abused. Which is a whole other thing, which I know you're already mad. So, sorry about that.
I mean, that's okay. It's been 6 years, you know, this all transpired like 2016 and 17, right before I left. And I left in 2018. Anyway, yeah.
Okay. Right. Okay. My goodness.
Then lots of therapy later.
Lots of therapy. Gotcha. Okay. So here, that was one of the things that really was this turning point when you saw how it happened, the people,
organization,
right, and the organization is going to not know how to deal with it, and they don't even really, it seems, have any kind of way of being organized around helping someone who has been harmed by the leadership or by the organization, and instead they want to protect their own. Which is reprehensible, of course, and you see it a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know if there was another story that was really the catalyst or if that was it and then you were done.
There was the woman in the Seattle group that was being raped by her husband as well. And that sort of was my last straw. It was like, that was also handled really inappropriately. And none of the people that I know that were harmed were given any kind of directive to seek outside counseling, because outside counseling might have a different point of view about their ideology and their worldview and might interpret maybe what's going on as harmful. If you have enough moralizing about thoughts and emotions and behavior and moralizing of how you need to move in the world, well, maybe your therapist might have an opinion about that, you know? So, you know, I didn't have to like, you know, each center is its own little universe. So I'm not in a commune. I'm not in a, you know, it's not a totalizing organization in that way where you're stuck together. And it also didn't help that the instruction for meditation in Gnosis is abysmal. Because it's written by some guy and retranslated, and he didn't know what the hell he was doing. Thankfully, the first teacher that we had actually taught kind of outside the box. I give him gratitude for that, because we would go to Buddhist retreats at Cloud Mountain, if you know where that is. It's kind of a great like conglomerate of different teachers that come in, so you have different ideas about what meditation can be. And so we would go to learn, because teaching out of the book was awful. And so we would go and learn what real meditation was and have so much more success in that than any of the Gnostic practices. So I didn't have to tell anybody, but I chose to tell two women, call them on the phone, and they were, of course, very condescending and like, oh, well, at least you'll stay on the spiral path instead of be on the straight path with us, you know. But that's its own value, that's its own virtue, and you know, maybe next lifetime, blah blah, you know, multiple lifetimes, etc. And I wasn't expecting anything different, and I was like, yep, I guess I was right. And so at some point I posted, like in the fall, so that happened in the summer, and in the fall I posted a picture of this book, which is very thin, but asks very great, basic, open-ended questions. You know, they're not, you know, it's just like, well, what was your structure like? And evaluate your system. And I posted something on Facebook like, oh, I guess this is my life now. And 2 weeks later, my husband gets fired from being a Gnostic by email.
Email after years of devotion.
After years of devotion. And unlike me, Justin is very much the social butterfly. And for him, Gnosis was the organization and was connecting to all of these different people and just sharing with sort of this lovely, inspiring sort of way, like, oh, isn't it great? We're all doing this great thing together. Where I was just like, I'm a skeptic naturally anyway. And so he just didn't, you know, he didn't worry about the incongruencies of the teaching. He didn't worry if like, oh, that practice didn't work. Oh, whatever. You know, I don't really worry about my thoughts. Where I'm just like, I have to worry about my thoughts. So like I left of my own accord and wanted to scorch the earth. I wanted to understand, and I didn't, you know, I don't really care if Gnosis exists or not, but I just wanted to understand what I had gone through. What I just wanted to get it and burn down, you know, like they had 17 years of my life. They weren't going to have more. I was going to take it apart. And for him, it's been a journey of grief because he wasn't expecting it. He wasn't expecting them to turn on him. And no one, you know, no one contacted him. No one was like, this was an email to all of the missionaries in our organization. And it was a bit of a blurb. The guy in Rome, he's very apocalyptic. It's what, you know, of course I'm not in the loop anymore. I don't know. In the last 6 years, maybe change his tune. Don't care. I don't have to be beholden to it anymore. But he's very, you know, so some stream of some apocalyptic dialogue about, you know, how we needed to continue to do the work. Don't stop doing the work. And then in a blurb, there was like, and you need to disconnect from these five people, two of which were dead. The other was the asshole from Portland. And then Justin and I were written in bold.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. Very talk. Important.
Very.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So he got fired and nobody really contacted him about it.
And that happens a lot, that people are just dropped.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah. You don't know that is what's going to happen to you when, I mean, and I wish a lot of people could be informed ahead of time about what a group really has in store for you, what their agenda is, and what's going to happen to you if you leave, if you speak out, if you're unhappy about anything that happened or about the way you were treated. That's going to be it. And they're going to move on. And you get a sense then in this huge, I think, wave of betrayal, which is quite painful. You really wonder how much they ever cared about you or if they needed to use you to keep them going, to kind of keep the machine well oiled. That's a terrible feeling, too. And I wonder, just with time permitting here, I want to be able to get into what has helped you since leaving and what has been difficult and just the healing and moving on process.
I mean, one of the things I'm incredibly grateful for is that our relationship, my relationship with Justin, has continued to thrive and evolve. And at the beginning, it was a little difficult because we, you know, he was fired, I left. He was kind of fired because I left. But for me and my need, just inherent need to deconstruct all of this scaffolding that was in my brain, my criticism and my anger were very strong. And his wasn't, you know, he had it. He still was in love with some of it. He wasn't damaged the way that I was through it. He didn't take it into his system the way that I did. And it took a year or two to kind of figure out, like, oh, he gets to have his own process and it looks different. And, you know, that's valuable. So yeah, I decided about a year after, it was like, I am still having nightmares. I am still anxious. I'm still dreading. I think, you know, hell is coming my way, that I've damaged Justin. You know, I did this to Justin. And so I needed to do that. I mean, this book did really help a lot, the Leave a Cult Handbook, you know, because the book really helped a lot. And of course, other books have too, but this was my initial thing. So going through that and realizing, like, I need to talk to somebody, like, I need to figure this out and to have my pain be validated. Like, yes, it was correct that I was being hurt by the doctrine and by the culture of Gnosis, the explicit and implicit expectations, like all of that. It was valid that it was damaging, like that, you know, I needed that clarification because that was my doubt. My biggest doubt was, like, I made the error of leaving because I couldn't hack it. This impossible thing that you're supposed to do, I couldn't achieve it. So my sense of self had just crumbled at that point. So lots of therapy has helped. And then I'm so inspired by other people's stories of their own process of deconstruction. Weirdly, the folks that I have found the most congruence with, even though it's completely different ingredients, is ex-evangelicals and people who dealt with purity culture. Because ours is like purity culture on steroids with the no sex. And, you know, you can't have a kink. You can't be gay. You can't want to explore sexuality in any way, shape, or form. It's just this very dry thing. They would just tell me I was doing it wrong, of course, but, you know. So listening to different podcasts, there's a couple of YouTubers I just adore. Things that are irreverent, you know, I love that. And just getting back to being a basic person and being okay with that. Like, not having to be special, not having to be working on myself all of the time, although I kind of still do. It's just a different formulation, but I am kind of getting to the kind of like narrowing down of like how much I have to work on myself anymore. I think I'm pretty close to at least putting a pause on therapy.
Okay. Wow. All right. So I know that we're done with our time today, but I think the fact that you're able to put such a extreme experience into this kind of perspective, take some distance away from it and look at it, takes a lot of doing. And I don't know if people realize how much that takes. The fact that you and your partner were able to lean in says a lot about the nature of your relationship, which is a lovely thing, and wanting to make it work and not wanting, I think, to have a group or anyone get in the way of what you have with each other. But you really have lived through a lot together.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've been very active in my recovery. And I think he gleans from that. Like, he didn't feel like he needed therapy, and that's his choice. But he gets to hear about all of my process, which he's like, yeah. Like, my anger has come down and I've been able to feel grief for all that I have lost, the community, the connections, all of that. Like, I've been able to grieve that and the good thing, acknowledge the good things that I did get out of it, because there very much were. But his anger's gone up because he's like, yeah, that is stupid. That is harmful. Damn.
Yeah. And so everyone has their own process and their own time frame for healing. And some people are slower to get there. It doesn't mean they don't get there, but they will sometimes put it off, maybe because I think sometimes we subconsciously intuit what it's going to feel like when it suddenly comes out. There's something really good about the fact that you have each other. And then when he's starting to get angry, he has someone to express it to. And you completely get it.
Yes, and I'm like, tell me more, huh?
Right? Sit down, have some coffee. Let's keep going. Right? And I also hear your anger, not only because of what happened to you, but what happened to other people who were so genuine in their connection to this group and their wanting to do good things and improve their lives in some way and were horribly mistreated.
Yeah. The last I'll say is a friend, another ex-Gnostic, and I have started a Reddit thread. It's one of the greatest places to have anonymity about an experience you're having. And we have lots of Gnostics that have come forward about other abuses that they've been having.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. So the group is still doing its thing.
Oh, yeah, it's still doing its thing. And including the branch that our organization represented. Like, I know of a lot of stuff going on in Australia that isn't great, and in Europe that isn't great, Japan that isn't great, and so on.
Wow. Okay. My goodness. Okay. All right. Well, so it was really, really good, really powerful to talk to you. And I'm so glad that you were able to come on. And if there's anything else that you wanted to share or even updates, you know, I know that you're going to be moving on from being immersed in the group, right? Because you're going to be able to help a life, but still, I know you care. So if there's any other information that you think would be valuable to share, please come back on.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you.
One more thing before you go. Thank you, thank you, thank you to Lynn for coming on and talking about her experiences. I know that this has been a long time in coming. There have been many years of relationship with this group, with the people in it. Luckily for her, as she talked about, she's been able to sustain her primary relationship with her partner, which is really lovely. But I know that groups will often really take their toll on relationships that exist that are love relationships, romantic relationships. So she is a lucky one, but I know, I'm sure, actually, that it came with a lot of work that they were determined, really, to keep their relationship going. One of the things that Lynn mentioned was this idea that it was sort of scholastic, that it had this kind of reputation for people who got involved, that it was intellectually driven, that people were going to be doing a lot of studying, a lot of exploring, that they were going to be assessing different philosophies and different theologies, different religions, different theories in general. And so when groups like this, and there are many groups like this, do this sort of combo platter of different everything that's put together by the leadership, it is also something that's usually not static, that you can get involved in a group and believe that these are all the teachings, and then suddenly it changes, and suddenly the leader adds something new. And everything is kind of fair game, you know, that you can just decide, or the leader can just decide to add another idea. Now, sometimes new ideas are going to be ones that contradict, really fly in the face of other things that you learned. So it can get confusing, but it's like this moving target, but you just have to follow along. And this is the new thing to learn, and this is what we stand for now. One of the things that also happens is that when a leader is quoting from philosophers, from religious leaders, from theorists, from people who are scholars in general, they give the impression that they are one of those people. So they have something in common with all of these high-level thinkers. Now, it could be that they are highly intellectual, but they are not well, usually. You just give them more of a pass, I think, when they can quote anyone. I know that if someone were to just be walking down the street wanting to gossip and or wanting to talk about a sports team or the weather, I might not assume that they're intellectual, but if they suddenly throw out the name Kierkegaard, I'm going to notice and I'm going to wonder what they know about Kierkegaard. I mean, it's actually pretty trippy and heady stuff, not easily understandable. But people do this a lot of time as a way to kind of launder their reputation, so to speak, to make themselves seem akin to all of these people they're quoting. In fact, I was recently reading the kind of manifesto of the man who really kind of almost seems like a boy at the time because he was so young, but the man who started the Billionaire Boys Club, if some of you remember that, in the 80s and 90s. And one of the things that I was struck by in this many-page guideline for how the group is going to be structured and the things that you are supposed to follow and the language that we're going to be using and the hierarchy and all of that is that it kind of starts with this quote by Shakespeare. And it was from Hamlet. And I thought that is purposely done because I think he really wanted to come across like he knew about the classics and then he should be taken seriously. And he is then an adult who knows about the finer things. He wasn't those things, but he could come across that way. When you have a group like this too, that goes into the realm of counseling, of doing psychology, which, believe me, so many of these groups do, you get into then what I feel is really dangerous territory. That's when you can decide that someone has a certain diagnosis. That's when you can offer them the kind of counseling that you have, but tell them they don't need counseling from anyone else, i.e. a licensed professional, similar to Scientology auditing. And so whenever you see people who might be suffering and you say, I have the answer for you, but you know you don't have any training beyond what you've been given in that group, then you're really not able to help them and you're putting them at risk and it's malpractice and it's neglect. And it's the realm where a lot of people who have a good conscience get into that then causes them to have a great amount of regret later on. That's where they can feel the most guilt, that they saw someone suffering. And like with meditative groups, they were told just to tell that person to meditate for longer, even though for a certain percentage of the population, meditation is actually an irritant. It's something that can make you feel more anxious and make you feel more depressed, make you feel more hostile even. And so if you're having those feelings, you want someone to say, actually, oh, if you just meditated and now you're having those feelings or that kind of agitation, that means that you might be a part of the population that finds that meditation feels toxic in their system. So I now know enough to know not to tell you to go do it for longer and do it for more or to berate you for not doing it right. I'm going to suggest that you find other means of help. I can count on one hand and maybe not even one finger how many times I've heard people say that, or I've heard that people have heard that in a particular cult group. Because you don't actually, if you're a trainer, if you're running a group, if you're guiding people within a group, you don't actually need to have a degree of any sort. But you are dealing with people in very vulnerable states a lot of the time. And so I feel like there should be a cultic malpractice that has its own category and can be legally recognized. One of the things also that happens is that when people feel this kind of guilt, they have this kind of feeling like they're going to just be berating themselves forever and ever for the harm that they put people in. But it is really important to know that typically you would not have done this of your own volition. You would not have caused yourself this moral injury. You would not have caused harm to someone you cared about while you were in your role of really purely wanting to help. All of that blame lands squarely on the shoulders of the leadership that told you it would be fine to do this, or told you you had to say these things to other people in order to quote unquote help them. So again, I've used this kind of idea before, and I quote it every once in a while, but I wanted to offer it to you again. When people ask me how much of this is my fault, when I was an instructor, or when I recruited new people into a group, but I really didn't know that it was destructive at the time. I only had the information that I had. I will often say, if you can picture a scene with three people where you have somebody who sees two people standing next to each other and purposely slams into the person in the middle with enough force where that person in the middle knocks the third person down. And the person at the beginning, the first person, did it with full intention to wreak that kind of havoc, to make that outcome. The person in the middle might feel very guilty that they knocked this other person down. And they might feel responsible for any injuries that they incurred because it was because of their body knocking into that person by accident that they may have caused them to get hurt. So yeah, I think you can take responsibility for that. But there's a difference between fault and responsibility, I think. It is not your fault. And where the fault lies, I think, is the most important thing to look at. And the fault lies on the person's shoulders who saw two people standing next to each other and said, let me see what damage I can do, and let me see if I can get the person in the middle to be responsible for causing another person harm. And I'm just going to walk away and enjoy that I was able to have that power. Sort of like the way cult leaders often are. They don't deal with the fallout of their actions, but they should. Talk to you next week. Take good care.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.